comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors. Kevin Smith Show. It is talk radio like nowhere else on earth. It's the show where you matter. Tonight is K-Files night. K-Files night. Well, what is that? K-Files night is the night we start sending out our free weekly newsletter. And if you're not subscribed and you don't get each week our K-Files, you got to ask yourself, where's the genius in that? Because it's free, it costs you nothing, there are no strings attached, and you can unsubscribe anytime you want to. And it's always just chock full of interesting and important information within our genre, and links to videos, links to stories, articles within our genre. Interesting websites, free download each week, audience feedback, all kinds of stuff. So there's really no reason not to be getting that. If you haven't subscribed, get over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. Right in the middle of the screen, you will see a big link that says K-Files. Click on it and enter your email address. You're going to get a confirmation email with a link in it you have to use in order to activate your subscription. If you don't activate it, it doesn't happen. Okay? So be sure you do that. Are you a member yet? Well, our members just got a free ebook in preparation for an upcoming show. That's just another of the good things that happens in our members area. There are all kinds of things listed for you that happen in the members area. And if you click on where it says join, it will take you to a page where it lists a bunch of the things that are in the members area. You can take a look at it and see if it's something you might want to be a part of. But there are all kinds of unscheduled good things that happen, things that aren't on that list that just happen because you're a member. And so they've just received a free ebook. It's over 300 pages, I think. But they just got it, and it's about a show that we're going to be doing. It's about the same topic as the show we're going to be doing in the near future. So if you're not a member, join tonight. It's only 23 cents. There's no reason not to be there. Think about that. Well, you know, you're missing out on lots and lots of stuff that happens here at the show if you're not a member. You can listen for free, but it's only 23 cents to join the community of members. 23 cents a day. That comes out to $6.95 a month, and that is a negligible amount. My guests tonight have been with us earlier this week. And that is a bit out of the ordinary. We don't do that too often. But we're doing it tonight, and we're doing it for a very special reason. Hang on to your hats. We'll be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I said at the top of the show that my guest tonight had been with us earlier this week, and that's a bit out of the ordinary. It is. It's not the first time that that's happened, but it is out of the ordinary. We don't do that often. They are with us tonight, however, in more of their regular role as Bigfoot researchers. And we're talking about Alex Hearn and Mitch Waite. Now, we had them on earlier in the week talking about this missile launch out near Phoenix, Arizona. But remember, the reason they were witnesses to this missile launch is because they were returning home from a Bigfoot research trip. They just happened to be in the right place at the right time and happened to have all their equipment with them, including HD video cameras. And so it just worked out that they got to be witnesses and got it on video, and it just so happens that Mitch has tremendous expertise in that kind of thing. So it was sort of a confluence of circumstances that brought them to the point of being the witnesses and thus the guests on Monday night. But what they are known for, best known for, on a long-term basis, is their work in Bigfoot research, cryptozoological research. And so, gentlemen, welcome back to the show in your regular roles with your regular hats on tonight.
Welcome. Thanks for having us.
All right. Is Mitch, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. You guys were coming home from a Bigfoot research trip. And I think I remember you saying that you had been in the Superstition Mountains. Is that correct?
Actually, we were behind the Superstition Mountains. We were actually in the what we call the Sierra Ancha Mountains, near Roosevelt Lake.
We're hearing all kinds of background noise. I don't know. It sounds like somebody chopping meat or something back there. Are you guys, are you hearing background noise?
Yeah, I've been picking it up.
Okay. All right. Okay, so you're beyond the Superstition Mountains, on the backside of the Superstition Mountains. And when you came home... on the way home, you saw this missile launch, and you, I'm very thankful for the fact that you were able to videotape it so the rest of us could see what went on. And, that has been, quite a mystery, and I don't want to talk too much about that tonight, but, you know, one of the things that really has been a mystery to me is the absolute ho-hum, so-what attitude of, the national media. And, you know, it's sort of, I had a conversation with a journalist who told me, this was a national journalist, who said, well, yeah, but you understand when I brought up, you know, well, that thing in California, they were all over it. And here, you know, there your witness was a news crew. Here your witness includes someone who's a retired space officer with U.S. Space Command, NORAD. And, well, yeah, and here, are you ready for this? But you see, Hillary Clinton that same day made the statement that that was probably the Chinese just flexing their muscles off the coast. And my response to that was, yeah, so what? When it comes to missiles, who's Hillary? What does she know about missiles? She doesn't know anything, and she knows nothing more about missiles than the reporter does or than the general public does. And she's not a missile expert. So it's been a little bit surprising for me. But nevertheless, what I do want to focus on is the thing you were coming home from. You were coming home from a Bigfoot research foray into the wilderness. And I want to start with Mitch, because I've asked Alex this question before, and Mitch, I haven't had the chance to hear this from you. With all of the expertise that you have in all kinds of really high-tech stuff, why are you interested in Bigfoot?
Well, actually, it was my wife that got me into it. She was collecting stories about the Mogollon Monster, which is Arizona's Bigfoot, and she compiled it into a book and published that way back in 1995. And it was more or less a collection of campfire stories as told by the locals of northern Arizona. And so I just kind of went along with it, and I wasn't really a believer or skeptical about it. And so we let it cool for a while, and eventually we noticed that her books were back on Amazon.com and selling for around $300. So I kind of thought, well, maybe we ought to republish this. So I started redoing some research and found out that she was being acclaimed as being the technical or the expert for Arizona's Bigfoot, which surprised us. Anyway, we started getting all kinds of reports and phone calls, and so we heard one about the Sierra Anchas, and we decided to go check it out. And while we were there, we decided to spend the night. We pitched a cold camp, meaning there was no fire, and during the middle of the night, our tent was squished on us. And I was semi-asleep, but while she was laying there, the tent squished down on her, she reached for a pistol and cocked the hammer back, and as soon as she did that, the tent flopped back up into a normal dome tent. And so we decided to vacate the area until morning. Well, it was a week later that Alex, I, Kyle Barentine, and my grandson, Preston Smith, went back for a closer look, a closer investigation. And that's when we found a 19-inch footprint about 20 to 30 yards away from the tent where it was at the time. So that's what got me started.
Okay. So let me ask you if you have ever seen a Bigfoot yourself.
Since that time, yes, I've seen him four times.
Mm-hmm. So there's no doubt in your mind that this creature actually exists.
That's correct. He does exist.
Okay, Alex, now for those who are new to our show and have not heard you when you were on our show previously talking about Bigfoot, very quickly give us a thumbnail sketch of why you are interested in Bigfoot.
Well, Bigfoot, I'm really more of a cryptozoologist, so I'm interested in everything, and it's mostly because of my childhood. I was lucky enough to grow up in Massachusetts and dealt a lot with the ocean and the shore and was able to see a lot of neat things and just always been interested in, you know, the unexplained, kind of starting there. When I was 12, though, on a hunting trip up in northern New Hampshire, we were staying very close to the border. We had traveled south on a third day to a location outside of Lincoln near Woodstock and a mountain location on the end of a mountain road at a person's house that we knew. They were the last house on the road. We went up into the mountain from their house. A couple of dogs followed us. And, you know, my dad was upset that the dogs were following us. They were following us because I petted them. And about 2 or 3 miles into his hunt, I said, "Dad, I'll take the dogs home, you know, because they're disturbing them." And they weren't on leashes. They weren't our dogs. Dogs in the forest in New Hampshire at that time. I'm not sure if the law is still the same, but they could be shot on sight. So he was upset that the dogs were going to get shot because of us. So I took them back. So about on the 3 mile walk back, something kept following us, and the dogs noticed it first. Then I'm trying to get the dogs going. I finally realized they were checking something out. It was behind me to the right. I started doing, take a few steps and stop, and thought I could hear something. And only because I was trying to get the dogs to go, but then I heard it too. And I it was comical. I'd start to walk and I'd hear a crunch or two. I'd stop and I wouldn't hear nothing. And then I'd, go again. And finally I just realized there's definitely something there. Didn't know what it was. Didn't think it was a cat or a bear. Figuring a cat would be quieter and a bear wouldn't follow me like that. It would eventually, either attack or move off. Deer in that area are pretty skittish, They'll let you look at them, but if you stare too long, they'll run away. There is no elk. There possibly could be moose, but they probably wouldn't follow you either. They're, very similar to an elk that stare at you and walk off like the huge fellow that me and Mitch saw the other day. So I knew it was something different. And when I got within the road, I started running. So the last 200 yards I ran, and I thought it was going to catch me, but it didn't. I came out onto the road. I had to go to the right because it was a mountain road to go downhill. And it was, on my right. So I thought it was going to come out, but it never came out of the thickets, out of the brush. And this, I was on a deer path, not, what we'd call a hiking path here in Arizona. It was barely a path. You close, scrape the briars. Back in Massachusetts, in those forests up in the Blue Mountains and the White Mountains of New Hampshire, it's Blue Mountains of Vermont, White Mountains of New Hampshire, it's thickets, It's not what you'd think of as a forest. It's really hard travel, and I was on a path. Whatever was following me was on nothing in the thickets, and it was crashing through, but it never came out of the forest. Got back to the truck. I sat there for a while. My dad finally came out a couple hours, 3 hours later. On the ride back to our motel and the restaurant, I wouldn't talk too much, so he finally got it out of me, and I told him, exactly pretty much like I told you. And just as I thought, he kind of made fun of me. We got to the restaurant, and him and his buddy and his son all kind of made fun of me a little bit. And the lady that owned the restaurant, it was her house that we were hunting at. And she came over, and, she was always friendly to me and my dad's friend's son, just a nice lady. And she said, "What's going on?" And I wouldn't say nothing, so she knew something was up, and, she got it out of them, and they said, Locke thinks, they call me Locke, Locke thinks something chased him out of the woods. And, so I told her the story, and she said, "Oh, he didn't come out, right?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, that's just Big Ben. He's just following you, making sure you got out okay, wondering why you're alone in the woods." And she looked at my dad, kind of zinging him a little bit. And, so everybody else that came in the restaurant that night, it was one of those diners, cafes where everybody local, if they didn't eat at home, they went there. Back in those days, it was probably 73. And, she said, "Oh, they'd come in, what's new?" And they'd say her name, and I forget what it was. But she'd say, "Oh, well, little Locky saw Big Ben today." And they'd be really, and, everybody came over and talked about it. And ever since then, I've been fascinated by what this creature could be. Had a couple of incidents when I was Boy Scouting, too. Was an avid camper and outdoorsman my whole life, so.
Okay. All right, so now, both of you have told us what got you interested. And let's now go to the other side of the Superstition Mountains. Why there?
It's an incredible area. It's almost tropical. The Sierra Anchoas kind of loop around this one valley that we're in, and Mitch has a name for it, Spooky Valley. The location we use for base camp we call Hot Zone, upper and lower, and it's surrounded by other mountain ranges too, which come out of the Mogollon Rim. And this one little area, Paradise Valley and south of it, is basically landlocked by these three mountain ranges. And then below them have the Superstition, too. So it don't get the same kind of weather as anywhere else in the state. It's tropical. It's literally tropical. There's ferns there. Now, this year, the ferns haven't got a stronghold yet. We're not sure they're gonna. But the forest itself is doing wonderful. Needs a little rain. It's starting to dry out, and they're getting flash fire conditions. So it's a very dangerous area right now. It's had flash floods, and it's had flash fires in the past. Both ended badly for a lot of people. I believe one of the floods had, you know, double-digit death. So it's a great area. It's a former mining area for uranium. So there's uranium mines and all sorts of other mines sprinkled throughout the area, but, you know, upwards of 15 uranium mines right in our little area. And, you know, cliff dwellings and hieroglyphics, all sorts of Indian.
Yeah, but why is any of that important? Why is any of that important to Bigfoot?
It's all what he needs for his, you know, environment or infrastructure. So there's wildlife. They're in the past, the long history of, you know, people living in this area. So there's abandoned apple orchards. There's fruit trees. There's berries. There's lots of edible greens. And then lots of wildlife. So we're thinking it has everything they need. Caves for shelter and lots of natural caves, too, not just the mines. Lots of forested, safe, unreachable areas almost, you know. You go two mountain ranges over, and you're talking 2-3-day hikes to get there.
All right, we have to step away for a break. And when we come back, we're going into the wilderness on a Bigfoot research trip. I've heard some pretty incredible things from these guys about what they've experienced, and I want you to hear some of what they've experienced as well. So we'll do that when we come back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guests this evening, Alex Hearn and Mitch Wheat. We're talking about, well, specifically Bigfoot research, but in a broader sense, cryptozoology research. And I said, we're going to take a trip with you guys and get out into the wilderness and experience through you some of the things that you've experienced. When you go out and do one of these Bigfoot research trips, you're not, I mean, you don't go out and just go camping, right? What do you do when you get to your location? What is it that you do?
You want me to go first, Alex?
Yeah, go ahead, Mitch.
Sure, Mitch. It's your turn.
Okay. All right. Generally speaking, when we get there, we try to get our camp set up, and that involves setting up our surveillance equipment and getting our cameras ready to go. I run anywhere between 4 to 12 game cameras, the stealth game cameras, out in the woods at all times, so we're constantly retrieving those cameras and checking the memory cards and putting fresh batteries in them and hanging them back up. We also try to go to new spots and check for sign, footprints, cat, broken branches. Bigfoot has a tendency to mark trail with a broken branch that where they'll snap the limb and twist it in the direction of their travel. Then we also, we're trying to establish a rapport with the land that lives in the area that we're working. So usually I'll go up into a large meadow and I will make some calls and noises, whistling, to try to get their attention. I'll leave them an offering on a tree stump of either some kind of sweet, like a something like a Hostess Ding Dong or maybe a Snickers bar or something like that.
And do they come eat it?
Yes, they do. Generally speaking, what they'll do is they'll wait till nighttime, and then they'll come down off the mountain. It's for them, it's only about a mile that they can travel down back paths and so forth. But for us, we have to drive about 7 miles. So a lot of times they'll come down to our camp at about 11:30 at night, and we'll hear them coming with what they whistle, and we'll know when they're starting to show up when they do that.
Okay, a couple of questions for you. The first one, you hang up all of these cameras, and I assume they're motion sensitive, so if something moves in front of the camera, it snaps a picture. Is that right?
Yes. Actually, I've gotten away from actual photos. I try to use video.
Okay.
Photos won't tell the whole picture.
Okay.
Video will.
All right. So we have seen, I think everyone has seen at least one documentary sometime somewhere about Bigfoot research. I've seen a bunch of them. And we've all seen where the cameras get activated and there's nothing there. And yet, all around where the camera was, there'll be footprints. I mean, we've seen incidents like that. So why do you think that there are footprints and no photos, no pictures, no video? What's up with that?
Well, I think they're extremely intelligent animals. I've had the cameras, I've pointed them down specific trails, and when I come back, I find them twisted around on the tree or down on the ground. And I've also gotten some pictures of hands as they're working on my cameras. And these hands are not human. They're probably about 11 inches or so long. They're very slender fingers. Gray skin. One picture even has some red hair on the back of the knuckles. So I think they just mess with the cameras to point them in a different direction than what they want or what we want.
Okay, the second question. You mentioned that they mark the trail. Why? Who are they marking it for?
Generally, members of their own clan. In the area that we're working right now, I think there's anywhere from 6 to 12 of them. I know there's at least one big adult male, two females, and at least two babies, possibly three, and then there's a bunch of juveniles that we deal with all the time.
Have you seen this family or this clan?
Yeah, I've seen the big guy.
How tall was he?
He was a good 8-footer.
Uh huh.
And my description of him would be, if you've ever watched Adam's Family and Cousin It,
mm-hmm.
Well, if you can imagine an 8-foot cousinette.
Really hairy.
Yeah.
Really, really hairy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he was very well groomed, which tells me he's got people or others that care me.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, did you get a look at his face?
Yes.
Could you make out any facial features?
Well, he looked like more of an aboriginal type features, with a fairly wide nose. He had light gray skin. And the look on his face when I spotted him was, oh, no, I've been seen. And immediately he turned and ran.
Did you get the impression, looking into that face, that you were looking into something of relatively high intelligence? Or were you looking into the eyes of something more like a great ape or a gorilla?
I think they're more intelligent than that. I think they're very, very close to mankind.
Okay. So what's your opinion? Is it a human or perhaps of a different species, but human? Or is this an animal?
That's going to be a big debate, because the genomes off some of the DNA or blood samples that they've taken from other areas, but that only two genomes away from being human, which is closer than a chimpanzee. So it would be very different. If somebody actually killed one, would they be accountable for murder for a humanoid, or would they be in trouble for shooting an ape? That would be something to be decided by the scientists.
Well, in a lot of cases, you know, killing an animal carries a heavier penalty than killing a human.
Yes, but if they're endangered, you are correct. You could serve more time.
That's right. Alex, what do you think? Have you seen this this big one that Mitch just told us about? Hello, Alex. Mitch, I think we lost Alex.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Okay, well, I guess we'll try to pick him up in the next break. But I don't know what's happened. Okay, so, Mitch, when you saw this, you called him the big one, how far were you away from him?
I was about 30 yards.
Oh, you were close.
He was pretty close. I was driving down a kind of a two-wheel rut road in my pickup truck with my grandson. Alex and some other people were behind me in another car, but they kind of fell behind a little bit, and they didn't actually get to see what was going on. When I slammed on my brakes to stop the truck to get it to back up again to where I could look at it, my grandson that was next to me was thinking it was something in front of us. So he was looking in the wrong direction. But by the time I had gotten the truck stopped and backed up, I saw him disappear into a thicket about 50 yards away from where the cave was that he came out of. And so he traveled across that really heavily forested and had a lot of trash on the floor, down trees and limbs. And he covered that in a matter of a few seconds.
Were there any of the other Bigfoot of his clan with him?
Not at that particular time. We went and checked out the cave. We found some stuff in there where he had been laying down and then got up real quickly and dug his feet into the ground to run.
Weren't you a little bit nervous about going into this this cave where perhaps Bigfoot is living?
you know, you don't really think about it until...
Well, I would. Believe me, I would.
But, yeah, it gets a little exciting from time to time.
You ever had any close calls with a Bigfoot?
Actually, I haven't. They seem to, if you give them a chance, they'll run. That's what I have. If you leave them a way out, they'll leave peacefully.
Well, you know, I've heard that, but I've also heard, and I actually have seen this on a documentary about Bigfoot, heard about them throwing big stones at people. And I watched one documentary where they were in a little cabin out in the woods and had a metal roof on it, and this Bigfoot was just chunking rocks at this metal roof all night long, and just pelted the house with these big rocks. What's that about? I mean, if they really prefer to just go ahead and run away, what's the deal about them, you know, attacking with these rocks?
Well, the whole time that they attack, they'll be undercover. They'll be out of sight.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's more of an intimidation factor. They're trying to get you to leave, so they're trying to scare you enough where you will leave.
Mm-hmm.
When we first started work in the area that we're working right now, we got pelted with rocks and sticks quite often. None of them ever hit us. One of the sticks actually hit the side of my trailer and put a hole in the side of it. But another time, I was actually whistling to one, and he was returning the calls, and I heard him starting going up the mountain to the thicket. I started in after him and, you know, trying to get him to whistle some more. And he turned around and threw a big old rock that hit the tree next to me. And I got the message. It was, you know, don't follow me. So I backed off.
Well, yeah, I would think so. All right, we have to step away for a break. And during this break, we'll see if we can find Alex. I don't know what happened to him. All right, folks, Bigfoot hunting. That's what we're up to tonight. I've never seen a Bigfoot that I know of, but I think it would be cool. We'll be back right after this. In the telephones this evening, folks. So I don't know. We're going to try and make sure that I've got these guys on different lines than what we had them on. So let's see what happens. And what happens there is feedback, I guess. Okay. So Mitch, are you with us? Hello, Mitch.
Mitch, yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Alex, are you with us?
I'm with you.
All right.
Standing here with my hand up in the air.
Okay. Well, now, you would think that when we were talking about the missile, that's when we would have weirdness with the telephones. But I guess Bigfoot's a little more sensitive. Okay. Now, I had asked Mitch if he thought these creatures are human, or if they were animals, and we got his answer, and then I went to you, and we couldn't find you. So, Alex, your answer. What do you think about that?
Well, I was always of the opinion that they were a grade ape. And everything we did kind of leaned towards, you know, the practices that someone would do with a gorilla or an orangutan. And recently, there's a study that's going to come out, and I've been privy to some information that it's going to say, it's a DNA study, it's going to say that these creatures are closer to human than ape. So I've been processing that and kind of leaning towards that. But, you know, I'm still not 100% on that side. I'm kind of on the fence. And the recent activity that we had is much more like that of a great ape. Wouldn't you say, Mitch?
The behavior-wise, yeah, it seems that way.
You know, that specific event that we've been talking about, and I assume Kevin will want us to talk about it.
Yeah, let's do. Let's get into that. Before we get into that, though, Alex, before we get into that, you mentioned DNA. Where did this DNA sample come from?
Well, it's come from numerous people, and that's why I say it's a study. And I'm not privy to all the people that it's come from, but I know one of them because I am assisted on collecting the data. I was actually supposed to be the one to pick up the toenail that is part of Melba Ketchum's study, and process it and get it to Tom Biscotti. But I was on a expedition of my own that day, a five-day expedition with 12 people. So Tom had Rex Howdy Shell pick up this toenail, meet Larry for the first time, brought it back.
Who is Larry?
Had it sent off to DNA.
Who is Larry?
And Larry Jenkins here in Arizona is the property owner that found the toenail.
Okay.
I've since become great friends with him, of course, because we're nearby, have access to his cabin south of the south rim of the Grand Canyon, north of Seligman, at any time. And I've spent a lot of time up there. Repaired the roof. We didn't put it on. He put it on. But we repaired the roof this July.
Okay, so now this DNA study has been done, and it was determined that the DNA was not from a human. Is that correct?
Correct. It's the first collection that we heard, somewhere in the range of 98% human and 2% unknown primate. Somewhere closer to a human than a chimpanzee or a Neanderthal would be, but not a human. And I'm not sure if that is going to be the specifics of the DNA study. Now, this same DNA scientist has collected multiple samples and is, you know, has not as of yet come out with her full findings. And so I can only speak for the toenail, of which I'm privy to and associated with, and Larry's a great friend to this day.
Okay, so, but you said even though this shows that they are closer to human than they are to the great apes, you still think because of their behavior that perhaps they are animal?
Yeah, they're very territorial. Although they can mimic humans, they seem to still have the territorialism and natural social order that an animal would have. And we can only go by our assumptions. So none of this is written in stone. You know, one thing as a scientist or a researcher, I'm constantly adjusting my opinions based on the data that's collected or new information that comes out. So I never, ever, ever, that's the one thing you can guarantee, I will never say anything's a sure thing. But in this case, my opinion right now is that they are maybe the closest creature to human and very, very similar to human, and they know that. But they're also still an animal, and they're creatures of the forest. They're a much higher intelligence than we think chimpanzees and gorillas are. But, you know, there's some pretty intelligent chimpanzees and even some gorillas that are pretty intelligent and saved little kids. More than once, children have fallen into the enclosures of gorillas and been saved by one of the primates. So gorillas, chimpanzees are pretty intelligent. Mitch and I have seen examples of chimpanzees, you know, in a military-like attack on smaller monkeys. You know, they're all very human-like. We just think that this one is a lot more human-like. But do I think it's human? I don't think so.
Would you agree with that, Mitch?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. They're almost human, but not quite human. If they are an animal, I'm not sure where their family branch comes from, as far as being hominid, or I don't believe they are part of the line of Gigantopithecus. I think they're more of a hominid. But they are very intelligent. Sometimes I think I should be playing chess with these guys.
We are playing chess with them, Mitch.
All right, so now let's go on. You were talking about this behavior being more animal-like, and you started to describe for us. So let's go on that trip and describe for us what you encountered that makes you think that they are more animal-like than human.
Mitch, I'll let you start.
We're talking about the chest thumping?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, when we first got into our camp, Alex heard some crashing through the bushes, and then it stopped, and I think that was just one of them moving through the bushes to a safer place. And as we were checking the camp out, we always go through and look at the ground for any prints or anything like that before we move in. And so we were doing that. We were walking around talking about where to set up cameras and my infrared camera system that I have. And we were coming back into the edge of camp, and we heard some chest thumping, and that's more typical of a gorilla.
All right, we've got a break taking over. We're going to step away for break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Alex Hearn and Mitch Waite, and let me just check and see if both gentlemen made it through the break. Are you with us, Mitch?
I'm still here, yeah.
Well, that answered the question about Alex, didn't it? Okay. Well, Mitch, we'll continue with you, and we'll try to connect with Alex again. He's having some problems with his phone line, I think. We'll try to get him back on in a little bit. So there was this chest thumping kind of thing going on, right? What's that about?
Well, in gorilla language, that's basically an answer to a threat. It's and, you know, I'm the tough guy on the block, and you're going to mess around here, you got to mess with me, type of a thing.
Yeah, you know, we even see human tough guys go through that. You know, they slap their chest, and you want some of this, you know. Yeah, that's, I can see that.
Well, we had three different instances within about 5 minutes of this chest bumping, and so we did what we normally do, and that is we we don't act surprised. We don't stand around like a deer in the headlights, you know. We go about our business. And so after we got everything ready, our camp set up and so forth, it started getting dark. And we started getting some whistling. Now, the whistling came closer, and then it was, as far as we could tell, it was just across the creek and across the road, sitting on the hillside watching us.
Okay, and what's the whistling about?
I think that's a general method of locating each other. It's a sound that kind of penetrates through the trees and so forth. So it's just a I'm over here type call.
Okay, I think we got Alex back with us. You still with us now, Alex?
I'm with you.
What do you think about the whistling? What's that about?
About the what?
Whistling.
Well, we've had whistling numerous times. This time, first we had the territorial grunts of a month past, and then the chest beating, and three times on this trip, and then later we had the whistling. So Mitch kind of put it together, and I was thinking in that regards, but he basically spelled it out. We had an individual, probably a young female, on the hill whistling at us for hours.
Okay, why?
And she's... Excuse?
Why?
Well, why would a female whistle at another male at any time?
Ah, it's a mating call. She's got eyes for Alex.
Or Mitch, but I'm thinking Alex. I'm thinking the territorial grunts we heard and the thumping is probably towards Alex from another male. And it could be towards Mitch also. But I feel aggression there. And I think there's a reason that they're not following through with the aggression. And that's probably because they know Mitch is coming there all the time. We're all coming there all the time, but Mitch more than anyone else. David's with Mitch. Preston's with Mitch. I'm with Mitch. Very rarely am I there without Mitch. Very rarely are any of the real researchers there without Mitch. And that's just the zing for the other researchers. Just kidding, guys.
They're used to Mitch, and because they're used to Mitch...
Vegetation. I'm sorry, Kevin.
They're used to Mitch, and because they're used to Mitch, they're not happy that you're there, but they're not going to attack.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, how often do you encounter this whistling? I mean, is this a normal thing? If we go out on a Bigfoot track out through the wilderness and we set up camp and we hang up cameras and we do all the stuff, is it normal for us to hear this whistling?
It is and it isn't. We hear it a lot in this location, and I'm also thinking we hear it a lot in the spring, but I haven't proven that yet. But, you know, these incidents where we're having the playful activity that, you know, seems to be in the spring and early summer. So maybe, you know, just like any other animal, spring and early summer is the time that they start getting in that, you know, pattern.
Okay.
The gray wolf, of course, is a big thing in Arizona, and they sent out a notice today, an update, the monthly notice, and, you know, of course, the they're hoping that there'll be some spring puppies.
All right. Now, you go out how often on these treks?
Well, sometimes pretty often. We've been out three times in the past month just for one-nighters, two-day trips.
What's the goal? What are you looking for? I mean, what is it that is would say to Alex and would say to Mitch, bingo, that's it, we got it. What is it? Are you want to capture one or what?
Well, we're both not pro, you know, non-kill. We are not pro-kill. But what we hope to do in some fashion is habituate with the species, just like they've done with gorillas, orangutans, you know, somewhat with bears and wolverines. You know, there's been some mishaps with the bears, and we don't want that to happen. But that's basically the only real science that we can justify, because we're not going to kill one of these creatures. You know, like I said, I'm not of the opinion they're human right now, but that could change, and I don't want to be the one that kills one of these creatures anyway. So Mitch, I think, has a similar opinion, but I'll let him answer for himself.
All right, what's the goal for Mitch?
Well, I want to sit down and have a peanut butter sandwich with one of them.
Seriously?
Seriously.
We're 100% serious.
Yeah, I've been, like I said, I've been going up there quite a bit. I always wear the same red shirt, and I advise all the people that go with me that they should also wear a red shirt so that they, the Bigfoot will know that they're part of, my group, so that they're not ostracized or not threatened with testing and so forth. If I remember right, Alex, you were wearing a yellow shirt, right?
Since you gave me that shirt, at least to this location, I try to wear that shirt every time out. And, you know, mostly when I'm doing my research, I'll try to wear that shirt or one of my camo shirts, you know, obviously to help promote you a little bit because you do so much for me. But I want them to get used to that shirt, and you guys know how I feel about camos. Kevin, I think these creatures understand that, you know, when they see these camos and fatigues, they know they got some, you know, militaristic hunting type, and they stay away. So I don't even carry a weapon anymore as long as someone else has one.
All right. So your goal is to sit down and have a peanut butter sandwich. Why?
Well, I think that's probably the way we're really going to prove if they exist or not, is to continue to collect constant data, reaffirming data from different technologies, different sources, until eventually we go, that's enough, they exist, you know. So I have surveillance systems on my trailer that are infrared. I can see in total darkness, and I usually set up my camp and try to be as inviting as I possibly can to these creatures. I do believe I had one in my camp one night. It was a young female. We did catch her stealing a Diet Coke and a foil of cookies. you know, that was with a game camera from quite a distance. But with my surveillance system, I can go probably 50 to 70 yards in total darkness and see very well.
All right. Now, early in the show, you mentioned that you set up these cameras, and they're all over the place, and then you go around and check them, and sometimes you find that they've been turned around. They're facing another direction. Does there seem to be a direction that's preferable? I mean, like, do they turn them usually to the north or to the east or anything like that? Or is it just kind of a random thing?
It's usually pointing into a bush or maybe up at the sky.
Okay, so there's no certain direction that they will turn. And when I say direction, I mean there's no point on the compass that's usual for them.
Correct.
That's a great thought, though. I don't think we've ever looked at that specifically. Have you, Mitch?
I can just remember the time I found them, and I don't think they were pointing in the same direction.
Usually it would be at a bush or somewhere they're not going to walk, right? Into the sun,
right.
Into the sky, at a bush. You know, we'll aim them down a path. So basically, all they have to do, you know, Mitch is pretty good at this too. It's, some of his animal photographs are pretty amazing. I don't want to sound like I have a man crush on him, but boy, he's got it down.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of witnesses and the photos prove it. But he'll survey an area. He'll see where, you know, even it could be a pasture, and there's no specific area that you would think, you know, these animals will come to, and he'll walk up to an area, and almost dropped my phone there, I'm trying to hold it up high. He'll come to an area and say, okay, this is where we put the cameras, they're going to come right through here. And we'll get the cameras a month later, and here's, you know, like Grand Central Station for deer and elk, you know, and sometimes other a tail here or there. This last trip, he got a tail of a cat, and that's not hard to do. I mean, not easy to do. What a great planning and location he picked out, you know.
All right, is there any particular time of the day that seems to be the most active time to make contact with these creatures?
Mitch?
Mostly time. They're mostly nocturnal.
Okay, early evening, late evening, 2 o'clock in the morning, what are we talking about?
We think like deer and elk and other animals, they, you know, right at dusk they come out for their evening. We figure in most of the daytime they're going to be bedding down, either sunning themselves or, when it's real hot, cooling themselves. And the only time you probably see them during the daytime is if they're doing some travel, which they do. I don't know if we believe in long-range migration patterns. I believe both is possible, but not, you know, also not a sure thing for every one of these creatures. The creatures we have certainly stay in this area, but we do both believe in some long-range migration and some short-range migration, and at those times they may be traveling during the day. But in general, they're hiding out during the day and foraging at night. Unless they're spooked.
Okay, so again, what time of the night is the hot zone?
Well, we think they start right at dusk, like, you know, just like the deer and elk, they seem to come out right at dusk. And we think they pretty much continue right through the night, and probably sometime early morning head back to camp. And sometimes we feel these whistling and hooting and whooping sounds that we hear are them locating each other while they're foraging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very small clans, so we figure they spread out and do foraging to, you know, to cover as big an area as possible.
Have you ever seen a family of them together?
I haven't, but I've heard from others that have, and Mitch may have a different thought.
Most of the ones that I have seen so far have been individuals, but it, you know, it's usually you hear the others around. You can hear them crackling in the bushes or making hooting noises or something, so you know there's more than one. But generally, all you get to see is one, and it's usually only for just a fleeting moment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my second sighting, Kevin, which was up in the Apache Reservation, warm wishes to everybody up there, too. They're avid listeners of your show and all the paranormal shows, White River and McNary and the whole White Mountain Apache tribe. But I was up there on their behalf. We were north of McNary, and we were getting let in, a large crew, to a private location by some of the tribal members. And they, when we got very close to their location, they said, you know, we're going to go right around the bend here. There'll be a small lake that's there sometimes, and it was there. And this is where we think they're coming through, so we need to go slow in here.
So we slowed down. We had the windows down in the vehicles. We were still, you know, a couple miles to go. And in that last couple miles, we heard some sound calling from the right and the left. So we stopped all the vehicles. We fanned out with night heat seekers, night vision, and thermal imaging. And Rob Price, Steve Dismore, and I kind of flanked two. And that was a big one and a little one. And we had the little one kind of where we were surrounding it. And it probably could have ended badly. But at that time, some other members from the road of the trip caught on the thermal imager my location. They could see me. I wear the same kind of outfit until I get into a location, put my boots and secure pants on. I usually wear shorts. It's Arizona, and, you know, sneakers or less. And that night, we were heading into the location, so I wasn't yet, you know, dressed up. They're like, Alex, hold on. We all had radios. We see what you're looking at. We see you. We see Rob, and they described me, and they said, behind you is a large figure that does not have, you know, shorts and a T-shirt on. We see no clothes marks. They could see my belt and my gun. So I began chasing that one. And in that case, obviously the big one was distracting us from the little one that we had cornered. Just when that radio call came over, the little one had popped out and was right in front of me, maybe 20 feet away. It was in the moonlight this time, wasn't daylight, but he or she was swaying between two trees. And we had been watching them pop between trees with the night vision, and we had lost them. So we fanned out again. I went to the location that I thought they most likely were at, and obviously I was correct. And I was looking through my night vision, and, you know, it's a monocular night vision. It's a single lens. So it's kind of irritating when nothing's there. You don't trust it, and you pull it down. Just as I pulled it down, the creature stepped out from the tree, and that's when the other one was sneaking up behind me. And we do have incidents in the Enchilladas of, you know, hunters getting hit from behind so these creatures can get away. And that might have been about to happen to me, but I gave chase to the big one, which was even better because he just, you know, chased, kept going until I couldn't reach him a couple times, and the little one got away too.
You are both part of an organization in Arizona. At least I think both of you. I know Alex is, which is, it goes by the name ASCRO, Arizona's Cryptozoological Research Organization. And folks, if you go to my website and you scroll down, you see the picture about tonight's show. You can click on that. It'll take you to their website. Mitch, are you part of that organization?
Well, I'm kind of like a brother organization.
Mm-hmm.
I have my own. It's called MogianMonster.com.
Okay. We'll get that linked up there as well. All right, now... there are organizations all over the United States, all over Canada, all over Australia, all over Europe and Asia, organizations that are similar to yours doing the same kind of research. Are you guys in contact with any of these other organizations around the world?
I'm in contact with cryptozoologists and Bigfoot hunters all over the world, in email contact and phone contact when needed be, with people such as Peter Byrne up here in Oregon and Washington. I think everybody knows his qualifications. On occasion, I'll call John Bindernagel or email John Bindernagel. We have a relationship with Adam Davies in the UK, who has studied the Orang Pendek. Mark Fraser in the UK, who's mostly into the big cats, but also into cryptozoology. Down in the Southeast, we stay in contact with all the researchers, Tim Fasano, Jan Allen, Georgia Bigfoot, you know, up in Washington with the numerous organizations. Massachusetts, we have a researcher, Rex Howieshell, and I'll call Steve on occasion, Steve Culls. Of course, Tom in California and all over the world, you know, and numerous others, and Mitch is the same.
Well, the reason I asked is, for instance, we have a large audience in Australia, and a sizable number of those people have sent me emails over the years about this creature in Australia, and I think it's called a Yowie.
Yowie, correct.
And some of them have even been up into the Australian Blue Mountains on trips such as what you're describing, looking for evidence of and hoping for contact with the Yowie. Now, what I'm wondering, you guys have described some traits of these creatures that I think we can just put it in a basket and call it Bigfoot sociology. It's just some of their traits sociologically, the way they deal with each other and the way they deal with you guys. What I'm wondering is if you guys loaded up and went to Australia, went up in the Blue Mountains, and were fortunate enough to come into contact with some Yowie there, I wonder if the sociology would be the same, or would it be different? Would there be the chest beating, the foot stamping, the rock throwing, the whistling? I wonder if it would be the same or different. What do you think? I'll tell you what, we've got a break coming up. So during the break, you can think about what you think. I'm wondering, you see, if it's possible that they have a culture as opposed to just sort of a group sociology. Do they have a culture? If they're very, very close to human, then it's possible they have a culture, and that culture would very possibly be different there from what it is here. And I think that might even be a clue, possibly, to their intelligence. It might be a clue to let us know. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guests this evening, Alex Hearn and Mitch Waite. Now, before we went away for break, I asked a question about if we take two seasoned veteran Bigfoot researchers here in the United States of America, and we take you over to the Blue Mountains there in Australia, and let you do your thing there, if you made contact with Yowie, do you think that it would be pretty much the same sociology, or do you think there would be signs of culture, variations that would indicate, you know, some modification of the sociology? So let's start with Mitch. What do you think, Mitch?
I believe that you'd find some differences in their sociology due to the influences of location. However, I think there would be some very close similarities, too. We have been talking to people down in Australia and also people in California, Washington, Oregon, Canada, Alaska, and they basically tell me different instances that they've had, and I can see a lot of similarities of how they're being tracked and how they're being acted upon. But I also get some recordings of some of the vocalizations, and they're pretty close to what I have here. So, yes, there'll be very much of the same, but yet there'll be cultural differences.
Do you think that they're in their vocalizations? Now, this may sound like a silly question, and I'll give Alex a shot at both of these questions here in just a moment, but I want to get your response to this, and then we'll get Alex's response. In the vocalizations that you have recorded, do you think that there are regional accents? Now, that may seem silly, but I was in a bar in Belgrade, at that time Yugoslavia, now it's Belgrade, Serbia. It's called Ruski Tsar. So for all of my friends in Serbia, you know where Ruski Tsar is. It's in downtown Belgrade, and I was in there, and I was speaking Serbian with the bartender, and we were just telling jokes. And by the way, it was in the early afternoon, and I was in there for some ice cream. That's fact. And so we're just telling jokes and passing the time, and this guy walks in, and to make a long story short, he identified me as being from Texas. He heard Texas in my Serbian. He heard a Texas accent in my Serbian, my speaking Serbian. He had spent, I think, 3 years in Houston as a petroleum engineer, and he recognized the Texas accent. So what I'm wondering, do these Bigfoot have an accent in their vocalization where they can tell whether this is a stranger in our area or this is someone from our area, or, you know, can they tell?
Well, I believe they probably can. For instance, one of the things that they do in their vocalizations is they mimic the local animal population. For instance, coyotes or birds or something like that. And the population down there in Australia would be probably be dingoes and lions and whatever. So I think there might be some differences in vocalizations there.
Okay, but that would be making actual different sounds. I'm talking about make the same sound but with a different accent.
You know, I don't know. I would suspect there would be some differences.
All right.
I can't back that up with data.
All right, let's get Alex's response to that first question. If you got into the Blue Mountains and ran into a group of Yowie, would you expect that the sociology would be pretty much the same, or would you expect that it would be show variations and signs of culture as opposed to just animal sociology?
Well, quickly, one thing is that's exactly what Mitch and I would like to happen. So if anybody wants to help us get to the Blue Mountains of Australia, we don't mind. You know, feel free to get in contact with either one of us. And the last time, or first time on your show, I believe we had a caller from Australia.
Yes, we did.
And also, we have at least one member in the AZCRO forum from Australia also. And Mitch gets very many Australian posts on his videos on...
Okay, so what do you think about the sociology? Would it be the same, or...?
I think it's probably going to be similar, and their actions are going to be the same as a great ape. And that's what leads me to think that these creatures are, you know, just part of a primate family. Now, I'm thinking, though, humans would probably do some of these activities too before we got as civilized as we think we are now. Sociology speaking,
well, look, let me tell you something. I've been to a lot of fights as a cop, All right. I've been to a ton of fights as a cop and been in a ton of fights. And this thing about, you know, being macho and slapping your chest, I've seen that happen. And let me tell you, anybody here, anybody that's listening that's ever been in a bar fight or you've been in a bar where there was a bar fight, you've seen it happen too. So we humans do it.
Actually, you're right. I've seen people do it.
Yeah.
You know, come on. And they bang their chest.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, and every cop that's listening knows it's part of their training and part of their experience, the body language. When you see that, you know this is a person who's ready to go for broke. So.
That's correct. I'll have to 100% agree with you.
Yeah.
I think those kind of actions are going to be the same, but there will be some minor differences, especially due to the mimicking.
All right, so let's talk about accent. From one region to another, from one country to another, when they do their vocalization, do you think that there is an accent they can hear? And look, none of us hear our own accent. Everyone listening to me can hear Texas in my accent. I can't. But it's obviously there, and it's obviously pronounced enough that even when I speak Serbian, people can that know the Texas accent and who speak Serbian, they recognize Texas in my Serbian. So do you think something like that's possible with these guys?
I think there must. It would almost have to be. Would I understand it, or would Mitch? I don't know. I doubt it. But probably more than likely. As much as, say, different chimpanzees can tell each other apart, you know, when they're not from the same tribe or group or pod or clan.
There are people who, around the United States, who have claimed that they have had actual conversations with Bigfoot. Particularly, there's a lady, I believe, in Ohio, that has talked about this family of Bigfoot, and that one of them wanders up to her back door and has asked her in English if she had some garlic, because he apparently likes to eat garlic. Are you familiar with that story?
I am. Facebook friends with Janice and with all the people that she has worked with.
Mm-hmm.
Including Igor Burtsev, the Russian scientist who is traveling through this area right now. He was planning on stopping in Arizona with Mitch and I, and he spent a little bit too much time in other locations, and I think he's going to have to skip Arizona so he can get to Ohio for the Bigfoot conference. But he last was in touch with me right before Mitch and I went out in the field, and he was going out in the field. I'm not so sure if people around the Bigfoot community totally believe that story anymore. I am not privy to any of the new sensational information that says she's not telling the truth, and I would never do that. Do I think it's possible? I 100% think it's possible. That's exactly what Mitch and I are trying to accomplish. So who are we to say that someone else hasn't done it or won't do it first? I know some people feel that she is part of a cult and it's all satanic worship stuff. And, you know, whether that's true or not, I don't know. But that's how far people will go to try to discredit someone who says the things that she does. And she could quite possibly be telling the truth, especially if things happened the way she claims over three generations. I think she says that her grandfather made friends with these creatures, so it's quite possible, and it's very rural in those locations. I don't know if you can get as far from civilization as you can in Arizona, Utah, Colorado. But
hey, all you have to do to leave civilization in Arizona is just cross the state line into Arizona.
That's correct.
There, I mean, now that sounds like I'm being nasty about Arizona. I'm not, but people who live there know. There are only a few clusters of places, you know, where there are, you know, a sizable number of people, and most of it is wide open.
I'm in the outskirts of, you know, civilization here, but my town is 250,000 people. But last year we had a bear wandering through town, mm-hmm. and you can see how often I'm losing my cell signal. And I'm only 7 or 8 miles from Mitch, but you go another 7 or 8 miles and you're in the desert. So
yeah,
it's just how it is here.
Well, where I used to live in Mesa, I could go out to the street, go out the drive to the street, turn right, and it's all populated, and there's stores and streets and civilization. I can turn left and go 2 blocks, and I'm in the wilderness.
Yep.
2 blocks, and I'm in the wilderness. And so it's like that all over Arizona. All right, so we've talked about the possibility that there's some sort of accent difference, and of course we have not established that there is. We've talked about the possibility of some cultural differences between groups, different regions of the world. And the reason I've brought that up is, and we've also just talked about the story where the lady has contact with Bigfoot, and this creature speaks to her in her language, in English. Okay, now some people, like you say, will believe that. Some people don't. Doesn't matter. But what I'm looking for is any sign that this is not just an animal. Any you know, if there's cultural differences, the variations could indicate higher intelligence. And not just animal instinct, but, you know, actual cultural differences. If there's differences of accent, that would indicate that it's not just, you know, animal sounds by which they communicate, but actually some type of language that they're using that we don't understand.
Well, I do believe they do have a language. I've heard them mumbling in the bushes before. They use their language whenever they're in close quarters to each other.
Okay, we're going to have to pick that up when we come back, and I do want to pick that up. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are on Final Approach, ladies and gentlemen. That means that, of course, we are racing toward the end of the show like running toward a brick wall. It is coming up. My guests this evening, Alex Hearn and Mitch Waite, and we're talking about these amazing creatures called Bigfoot. Some people say, well, I don't think they exist. I don't believe they exist. Nothing to believe here. They either exist or they don't. There's nothing to believe. Something leaves those gigantic footprints out there, and whatever leaves those footprints exists, whatever it is. And but there's nothing to believe or disbelieve, or, you know, I mean, that's fantasy land. You need to get over that. If you're living in the land of believe and disbelieve, you're living in the land of make-believe. That's kind of like spending your life in Disneyland. So you got to get over that. They either exist or they don't. And these are guys who are going out and doing research, and they, like many, 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 many people around the world, say they have seen them. Now, when we went away for break, I believe it was Alex, you were telling us about hearing them talk to each other. Is that right, Alex?
It was actually Mitch.
Mitch, okay, Mitch, you were telling us that you've heard them mumble to each other?
Yes, on several occasions.
What did it sound like?
It sounds like a drunken sumo Japanese wrestler cussing out his wife.
Okay. So it's kind of guttural and choppy?
Yeah, it's low, it's gruff, and it's kind of a mumble. And I believe that's only used when they're in close quarters and they're basically talking to each other. And then they use the other vocalizations and other means of communications like rock knocking or tree knocking or whistling for long distance communications. And on several occasions I've heard it. My brother has heard it. I don't know if Alex has heard it or not, but we have.
All right. Have you detected any patterns in, like when they're taking a tree branch and whacking a tree with it, knocking on a tree with it? Have you noticed any kind of pattern to that?
Well, sometimes the whistling or the tree knocking or the rock clicking, and I have heard all of it, will be over a long distance, so they're getting a directional marker off each other. I haven't noticed any pattern to the amount of knocks or movement or anything like that. Haven't quite heard it enough to formulate that kind of opinion. But we have heard all of them, and from longer distances but short ranges, you know, in that short long range, they'll use the whistling. The rock clicking will go, of course, much further, and the tree knocking, especially in a canyon, can go a long distance.
Mm-hmm. But you haven't noticed any kind of a pattern that...
Or if they think nobody's around.
You haven't noticed any sort of a pattern to it, though?
No, we haven't, I don't think, seen enough to notice if a whistle or a number of tree knocks means a direction or anything like that.
Okay, well, where do you go from here? What's next?
We're going to continue with what we're doing and hope to habituate with them, you know, and eventually, you know, sit down and have a peanut butter sandwich or something similar.
How about you, Mitch? Hello, Mitch.
Are you here?
We're not hearing you. Okay.
How about now?
Yeah, we can hear you. So what's next for you?
Well, I'm going to continue start to collect data. Hopefully I will collect enough to be able to start putting the puzzle pieces together as to whether there are patterns in tree knocking or if their guttural language is actually a language or just what it is. And I have heard that there is a linguist or a cryptologist that is working on solving their language. And somebody was telling me about that the other day. Alex, do you know anything about that?
No, but I don't know anything other than what we heard about it the other day, in that there's someone that feels that, you know, they can solve the language. I don't know if there's anyone that's actually heard them talking enough to do this.
Are there recordings of this talking?
I believe there are. There are people that say they have recordings of the talking. I don't believe there are. I know there are. I play them on AZCRO TV, AZCRO News TV, which is a 22-hour loop of crypto and Bigfoot shows and YouTube clips. It's really informative. But there are some sound recordings of the guttural language of screaming, calling, of different kinds.
And I myself have heard communications of a loud nature. I can't believe they didn't know I was there, or if it, you know, was Bigfoot or not. But I was on the top of Mount Baldy at the highest lake in Arizona, Lee Valley Lake. It was near dark, and I heard what sounded like an Indian chant from one side of the lake, an answer from the other side of the lake, both, you know, across from me, but from the east and west, or left and right. And then it did it again two more times, just like that. And that was, you know, like an Indian chant or song almost that you would hear in an old John West movie.
Okay, so why do you think it was Bigfoot and not some Native Americans?
Well, it's very remote up there. You know, I'm at 10,000 foot level. There's no road to the back of the lake. There was no one else in the parking lot. No one down at Sheep's Crossing. So I had the whole area to myself. It was Father's Day last year.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just an enchanting sound, but it was very, very similar to what you would have heard the Apache do years ago.
Have you ever heard anything like that?
Maybe I heard something that was of Apache lore, but I just, you know, assumed it to be the creatures. And that's why I was up there investigating reports.
Okay. Mitch, have you ever heard anything similar to that?
Well, I've heard them speaking in the bushes.
Okay, but you haven't heard them chanting?
No.
Hmm. All right. Gentlemen, I want to thank you for being with me, and if you will, just stay on the line for a minute or two here while we bring this flight of the Kevin Smith Show in for a landing. Don't forget, folks, we begin sending out the K-Files tonight, so if you haven't subscribed, you need to hurry. You can do it right now. Just go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, click where it says K-Files, right in the middle of the screen. You can't miss it, although some do, and subscribe. It's free, and there's no reason for you not to be getting one of the best newsletters available out there. It really is. And we'd like for you to be getting it. You can unsubscribe if you don't like it. There's no problem. You can do that. No big deal. All right. We've had a great week this week. There's no question about it. This has been a stellar week, and I appreciate you for being here. We've got another great week lined up for you for next week, and I hope you'll be here for each and every show. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you'd like to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.